Hi everyone, welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at University of Idaho. I'm your host for the day, Kyle Fawnensteel, Media Relations Manager at U of I. I'm joined by my co-host and longtime podcast host, Lee Cooper.
Hello everyone, I'm Lee Cooper, editor and science writer here at U of I.
Thanks for coming on the show, Lee. Today, we'll talk about creativity in the legal world. So, to kick us off, Lee, how do you define creativity?
Oh, goodness. Existential questions in the morning. I don't know if I have a great, like, Webster's Dictionary definition off the top of my head, but for me, whenever I think about, like, the perfect example of creativity, obviously I can, you know, pick a great artist or musician or something like that, but, you know, I grew up as sort of a scientist, and for me it comes down to the scene in Apollo 13, which, from what I understand, actually happened in real life, at least to a certain extent, where the CO2 in the capsule was rising, and they needed to, obviously that's bad for the astronauts, and they needed to scrub out the excess CO2. So, but they realized they didn't have the right shaped canisters. They needed to end up fitting basically a square peg in a round hole using only the things in the capsule. So they threw them all out in front of the engineers and went, go for it. Save their lives and do it pretty quick if you can. And to me, that's like, you don't have the answer. There is no right answer. You don't know where you're going with it. So you're working to solve a problem and think outside the box to make this new thing happen. And they did it. And to me, that one, it's my favorite part of that movie and gets me really excited about creativity.
If you asked me, I'm not sure what I would say is my definition of creativity, but I lean on some advice that's somewhat similar. As I was learning photography, one of the best pieces of advice I was told was to show me something different. Show me something you can't see with your own eyes. I like to think that creativity in life is somewhat similar, about doing something different and doing it for a reason, but I know there are lots of different definitions.
There always are.
Today, we'll talk with Jason Dykstra. He's a professor in University of Idaho's College of Law, who's researching the importance of creativity in law. Jason, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you, Kyle. It's great to be here.
We're excited to have you. To start, could you tell our listeners about yourself and what you do?
I'm Jason Dykstra. I'm with the University of Idaho College of Law. I have taught a number of subjects over the last 3 years since I joined the college. I'm the director of the University of Idaho College of Law's Housing Clinic, and that is a wonderful vehicle for teaching creativity to our students, because you know, it gives us that chance to have real-world clients with messy, ambiguous, real-world problems. And you know, that's exactly the area where you need innovative, creative solutions to help your client get to where they want to be. So I think clinical education is a great area for teaching creativity in legal education. Beyond that, the University of Idaho College of Law, we're doing some really fun, innovative things throughout the curriculum. It's always exciting to talk to my colleagues about, you know, whether it's the way they're approaching teaching in the classroom, the way they are putting together real-world problems, or as we send students out to do pro bono work in the community and to work as externs placed out in the community. It's always a great opportunity for our students to prepare not only for the practice of law, but to also practice the sort of creativity that is necessary for the effective practice of law.
Can we start from the beginning and talk about what it's like to practice law and to train to practice? What does that look like now, and how does creativity play a role?
So before I started teaching, I practiced law for about 20 years. And in that time, I noticed the practice of law was evolving. The contemporary practice of law is very different from where I started in the mid-1990s. But there are a lot of things that have remained static. The main one is that if you work at a law firm, you most likely are going to bill your time by the hour. This is a business model that hasn't changed much since the time of Charles Darwin. And it's something that the legal industry has really clung to. Since the mid-1990s, however, corporate clients have begun to approach their legal work in an enhanced, cost-conscious way. And so as a consequence, a lot of work is either retained in-house, outsourced. Corporate clients demand price concessions. There are billing guidelines that come into place. The net result is that the legal services sector's revenues have really not grown since the mid-1990s. I was curious about this, so I pulled a bunch of data from the gross domestic product, pulled out the legal services sector, and then if you tether those numbers, chain them to a particular year and adjust for inflation, you realize that suddenly the legal services sector, the gross income is the same today as it was in the mid to late 1990s. So this flatlined revenue has changed how firms function. And many of the areas that as a new practitioner, I received a lot of kind of on-the-job education because there were these billable areas that were sort of playgrounds where I could sit second chair at a trial, where I could attend a deposition and just observe. Those opportunities don't necessarily exist anymore. And so as a consequence, we need to prepare our students to be ready to generate revenue on day one as they enter the practice. The other problem is the lack of strategic planning at a lot of law firms has led to a situation where kind of the default answer to flat revenue has been to bill more hours and work more. And unfortunately, this has led to a real crisis of professional burnout amongst mainly younger attorneys, and then also high rates of depression and substance abuse.
That sounds like a bit of a numbers game, very focused on deliverables, hours logged, and income. And when you're not making enough money, you simply increase the hours. Is there anything that's missing in this model?
Definitely, because there is a point where you can only bill so many hours in a given month. And at some big firms, as an associate, you're billing 80 plus hours a week. That means probably 12 hours a day, Monday through Friday, plus a few Saturdays a month. Beyond kind of the professional burnout toll, the quality of the work that you're producing starts to tail off. And I think we have a real risk of a situation where attorneys are not coming up with innovative solutions for their clients. They're just in kind of burnout mode, billing away.
So as you do more with the same amount of time, you might see innovation and creativity slip. Could you unpack what creativity is and what it looks like?
It's a bit of a challenge because the study of creativity is relatively new. There are over 100 definitions of creativity. The gist, if you kind of unpack as many as you can, is that creativity is when we solve problems, create new stuff, raise and consider novel issues, or just ask new questions. And allegorically, you could almost think of creativity as sort of a neural food processor. And we feed sensory data and memories into it. They're blended, bent, broken up, and something new comes out. It can encompass combination of existing material. So you can think of like Steve Jobs. I think he said creativity is just connecting things. There can be a component that's really simplification. We jettison anything superfluous. I think of the jazz artist Charles Mingus. He said something along the lines of, look, anyone can make the simple complicated, but creativity is making the complicated simple. And more often than not, it's really a combination of, all of those things, asking the innovative questions, combining existing concepts, simplifying them, maybe even a little destruction mixed in there too.
Why is it important to be creative in life and in law?
In life, creativity is important because it's just pleasurable. We've evolved to be innately creative creatures. And our origins are gathering around campfires, telling stories, singing, dancing. Set the worn out tropes aside of like tortured artists, and creative people tend to be happy people. I noticed that as a practitioner, the attorneys who seemed the happiest with their practices were often the attorneys that had a myriad of creative hobbies and given a really broad, whether it's playing blues guitar in your backyard in the summer, or, you know, extensive travel, or writing fiction on the side. In the law, you know, the law is really rooted in adherence to precedent and incrementalism. It may not on the surface seem particularly conducive to creativity, but we do have those landmark decisions. And, you know, just over the summer, I was thinking about how there was a lot of coverage on Twitter's attempt to take over, the attempted takeover of Twitter by Elon Musk. And, you know, during that time, there were a couple mentions that came up of a mergers and acquisitions attorney named Martin Lipton. He was the creative genius, so to speak, who invented the poison pill in the early 1980s to fend off hostile takeovers. And so he suddenly, his name burbled up as, oh, here's this great creative person. So we kind of have this dichotomy where the law tends to be precedential and incremental. And it may feel like when a judge says, well, that's a creative argument, counselor, that's rarely a compliment. However, we also have, you know, the landmark Brown versus Topeka Board of Education cases, and we have the, you know, the poison pill to fend off hostile takeovers. And so there is a fair amount of creativity that's needed in the practice of law. But then at the macro level, as I mentioned, the practice of law desperately needs innovation. And there are commentators who maintain that, you know, really we should just let outsiders come in and bring creativity to the legal profession. But my thought is, you know, we as attorneys and professors and judges know the profession. We shouldn't let outsiders have all the fun. We should foster and bring creativity to the table.
If creativity is important, what makes it go away? How do we unlearn our creative roots?
I've learned that we're not entirely sure, Kyle. Adults seem to harbor a collective amnesia about our creative childhood. And in the 1960s, a gentleman, a psychologist named George Land, devised a creativity test for NASA. It was during the height of the Apollo project, and they were trying to select the most innovative and creative scientists and engineers to work on the most, you know, difficult issues and problems that the Apollo project was facing. So they came up with a very simple test. There's a part of me that's a little hesitant to say you can test for creativity, but it seemed to prove pretty effective. And so in the wake of the Apollo project, that test was given to thousands of kids and then thousands of adults. And eventually, I think it was given to over 1 million people. Incredibly, about 98% of five-year-olds scored at the genius level of creativity. In contrast, about 2% of 25-year-olds score at that level. So his conclusion was that non-creative behavior is something we really learn. Maybe it has to do with socialization during education. You know, we tend to focus on convergent rather than divergent thinking. Also, our brains tend to evolve to be ruthlessly efficient. So if we have repetitive stimulus, we tend to become very, you know, regimented, and you may not need to flex your creativity when you're just commuting to work. You just kind of follow ingrained preset paths, and your brain tends to slip into sort of cruise control.
How do we avoid our brain slipping into cruise control? How do we relearn creativity?
It's one of the exciting prospects is that the brain can really rewire itself to engage in new tasks, new skills. And I'm convinced we can relearn to be creative. Basically, anything that pulls us out of our routine ways, if we're trying new things, you know, viewing the world as a beginner, allegorically, you could say it's hard to think outside the box if you're stuck inside one that you've built over, you know, decades. I think one good example is the musician and composer Tom Waits. He likes to compose music either on unfamiliar instruments or with no instrument at all. And, you know, his feeling is that he's freer. There's no frets. There's no chords. There's nothing that really constrains him as he's composing if he pulls himself away from everything that's familiar. So I think there's something to be said for that kind of novelty, but you have to be careful. There are some guardrails we need to put on it, because creativity thrives in the stimulation of novelty, but too much novelty quickly can overwhelm us. So there's this zone where creativity can thrive. And maybe the example would be if I decided to take up aviation and learn how to fly a plane, that would probably be a lot of novel tasks and routines that would stimulate a fair amount of creative thought. But if I'm flying on a commercial airliner and the pilot passes out and I'm overwhelmed trying to listen to someone explain how to land the airliner, that's probably just going to overwhelm me. I'm not going to have the time to, for my brain to process and creatively come up with anything. So anything, whether it's travels, new foods, new activities, anything that pulls us out of the familiar tends to help us reignite the creative sparks.
This is really interesting. So what made you start asking these sorts of questions in a research environment?
Well, Kyle, I was at a conference where I was presenting at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas in the spring of 2019. And one of the other presentations was on creativity. So I thought, I'm a relatively creative guy. I'm in a band. I write songs as a hobby, and I enjoy music. So I thought it would be fun to go to the creativity presentation. And it focused on the four stages of the creative process, which were all nominalizations: preparation, incubation, illumination, and verification. And the more I thought of it, it just didn't make sense. I kept thinking about John Coltrane, and he somehow seemed to kind of zip line past all of these steps and didn't really bother with preparation, incubation, or verification. He just jumped right to illumination whenever he would unleash a solo. So that got me thinking that maybe there was an area here where the study of creativity is still almost in its infancy. We're about 50 years in, and I began to think about it in terms of how we could improve legal education by focusing on creativity.
What does creativity mean to you? How do you practice what you preach in your everyday life?
There are a number of components, but one of the big things for me is how I teach has been affected by the more I've learned about creativity. And one of the really important factors is anything that really kind of lowers our inhibitions and makes us relax a little bit. So the traditional law school classroom is kind of that intimidating Professor Kingsfield from the paper chase, Socratic discourse. And I've tried to really unravel that and have it be a more collaborative, respectful, positive place. And my students seem to react really well to it. Another thing I try to do is create a comfortable environment where, failure can be part of that creative process. And so I tend with my grading to try to focus more on the process during the formative stages than obtaining the correct answer. In addition, I try to have situations where I reward divergent thinking, just like in the real world of practice. I try to create problems where there is not a single correct answer. And so it can be, a little challenging, but I've found that my students' creativity tends to bloom with those in that type of environment.
What's one lesson you want us to walk away from this with?
Try to pull yourself out of your routine ways. If you drive the same route to work, try riding your bike or taking a different route. And you might find that you notice a lot of the things you usually would only notice on a vacation, like a beautiful sunrise or a beautiful sunset. I think the more you can pull yourself out of your routines, the more that you'll start to see the world in a little different light, and that can really spur your creativity. The other thing is just patience, and creativity takes time to percolate. And we live in a world where we tend to be in such a rush, to get from A to B, that often we don't stop along the way and savor that journey. I've been surprised in my research how many creative individuals mention stuff like walking and, you know, what they learn on how they just at a subconscious level may not be thinking of the creative or the problem that they were just working on at work, but as they go for, you know, a 30-minute walk, they're still processing that and the innovative solutions that can result if you just take a pause and give yourself time to let something percolate.
I think slowing down is probably good advice for a lot of people. You're also working on an upcoming paper on creativity. Could you give us a preview?
Certainly, the work in progress that I'm working on at the moment really digs into the neuroscience that underlies creativity. And maybe if we set aside, you know, trying to delineate steps or define, if we look at how modern imaging is giving us just a window into how creativity actually works, and then couple that with a little bit of the evolutionary underpinnings of creativity and how our brains developed over the last, you know, 6 million years, we have a kind of a wonderful opportunity to use that cutting edge science to start to define how we can better teach creatively. And then that in turn helps our students reignite that creative flame.
I'm very excited to read it. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you, Kyle. It's been great to participate in this series, and I'm excited to listen to all of the episodes.
Okay, Lee, what did you think?
That was super interesting, and it's not that I've never thought about creativity before, because, like I said, as a scientist, you know, it always comes up, the big names who come up with incredibly creative ways of looking at the world, and you take huge leaps in understanding of the world. And as a writer, you see the incredibly creative works that come out that win Pulitzers and that kind of thing. But he had so many different ways of looking at creativity that I find that interesting, about how even making things simple can be creative, which as a writer speaks to me, because writing short is always harder than writing long. But kind of going back to where I started with this is, yeah, I mean, what he's talking about, these creative leaps in our law do come, you know, once every few, I don't know, years, months, I don't know what number to put on that, but they're you know, few and far between. And you do see that in the sciences, in the arts, where somebody creates an entirely new way of painting, you know, and then everybody's kind of jumping on that bandwagon, or somebody has a new invention, the computer or something like that, and of course everybody jumps on that and, you know, tweaks it slightly for their needs or what they're maybe good at designing or painting. So you see these leaps of creativity in a bunch of other kind of schools of thought, but I think maybe we don't think about that in terms of law. And so it was interesting that he brought that up and showed how you see those same types of leaps with creativity and law that you do in other areas.
Yeah, I also really appreciated some examples of how creativity is still important in law, which most people might think of as really rigid. Here's a problem, and here's one definite answer to this question or problem. But it's a lot more complicated than that. Well, Lee, thank you. That's a wrap.
Absolutely. This has been an excellent season. I'm looking forward to next year.
I'm so excited to be back here later this year. Thanks, Lee, and thank you all for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit us on our website at uidaho.edu/vandaltheory to learn more about our research. Email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu. We are on all the podcast platforms. Please rate, review, and subscribe. I'm Kyle Fonensteel.
And I'm Lee Cooper.
Thanks for listening.